Morning snack time was 10:30 on the dot, a regimen established and maintained by Marianne, who believed that rigid adherence to a timetable was the key to effective parenting. She had placed glow-in-the-dark digital clocks in her children's rooms and had instructed them not to leave their beds in the morning until the first number had changed to 7. She also bragged of strictly enforcing a 7 p.m. bedtime with no resistance from the kids, a claim that filled Sarah with both envy and suspicion. She had never identified with authority figures and couldn't help sensing a sort of whip-cracking, fascist glee behind Marianne's ability to make the trains run on time. Still, as skeptical as she was of fanatical punctuality in general, Sarah had to admit that the kids seemed to find it reassuring. None of them complained about waiting or being hungry, and they never asked what time it was. They just went about the business of their morning play, confident that they'd be notified when the proper moment arrived. Lucy seemed especially grateful for this small gift of predictability in her life. Sarah could see the pleasure in her eyes when she came running over to the picnic table with the others, part of the pack for the first time all day. "Mommy, Mommy," she cried, "snack time." Of course, no system is foolproof, Sarah thought, rummaging through the diaper bag for the rice cakes she could have sworn she'd packed before they left the house. But maybe that was yesterday? It wasn't that easy to tell one weekday from the next anymore. They all just melted together like a bag of crayons left out in the sun.
Tom Perata is the author of Joe College, Election, and his newest novel, Little Children, is a dark, often comedic look at the lives of suburban men and women. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks, Rick.
Tom, your novel really seems to be about, in a sense, America the petty.
Well, I think most of us, you know, live small-scale lives, and we have to find our big dramas in the course of those small-scale lives. I mean, one of the things that I thought that made me want to write this book was the idea that you could tell, like, a grand love story in the most unromantic and banal of spots, which is, you know, the toddler playground, where parents are, you know, not looking their best, mostly not feeling their best, dealing with, you know, these emotional storms that they have to, you know, these tantrums from their kids. So I really was attempting to kind of find a big emotional drama in the pettiest place you could think of.
Your work is very funny, and you use a lot of interesting prose. It's super clear. Could you tell us about how you create this utterly transparent prose? It's as if you shined it up with Windex.
You know, I mean, when it's your style, I think it's what you write without thinking, in some sense. I was always drawn to the writers that I thought were, you know, in this American plain language tradition. And you know, everybody can draw the map from Hemingway. I put Bernard Malamud in there. He's a very crystalline writer. You know, Raymond Carver, Tobias Wolff, Richard Ford, the 80s minimalists. You know, that's the tradition I place myself in. But I'd also harken back to writers like Dashiell Hammett. You know, if you go back to his stuff, you'll see that same quality. And I think you know, it's always just what I've been drawn to. And in fact, I think Little Children is a little more flexible and internal. My earlier work is, I think, more clearly in a kind of minimalist tradition. I tried to use that same clarity of language, but to do a lot with the inner lives of these characters in this book.
There's a lot of fantastic dialogue that carries the story along quite quickly. Do you sit around playgrounds and listen?
Yeah, I sit around everywhere and listen. I think that's almost second nature now. But I also think, you know, a lot of this book is about the shock of becoming a parent, of immersing yourself in this culture that in many ways is like the antithesis of the culture that a lot of us were living in before we became parents. So I was like teaching in college and thought of myself as a very well-read, interesting person. You know, I was up on music, I was up on books, I was, you know, in the world. And then suddenly you're on the playground and you're dealing with this, you know, there's not a whole lot of conversation between the adults. You know, nobody's really up on anything. Everybody's tired. Everybody's cranky, and you just feel like, how did I get here? And one of the things I kept sort of telling myself is exactly what my main character, Sarah, tells herself in the first paragraph of this book. She says, I am a researcher studying the behavior of boring suburban women. I am not a boring suburban woman myself. And there's some desperate plea, you know, in that. Because, of course, I was there, and that was my life, and I was having to adjust to the fact that it was my life. But I did put in those hours, and you know, if you're a writer and you put hours in a place, it becomes fascinating because this is where people's lives unfold.
The lives that you describe are not uninteresting or banal at all. And part of this is the way that you describe them. Could you talk about taking characters who are stuck in situations that are, from the outside, uninteresting and turning them into compelling, suspenseful characters?
Well, you know, that's more an article of faith than anything else. You know, my first book, Bad Haircut, follows a kid in the 1970s. He's 8 years old when the story starts, and he's 18 when it ends. And purposely, he's mostly an observer. He's mostly watching things happen to his friends and kind of orienting himself morally toward what goes on. So the drama really is less what he does than what he thinks about what he sees. It's a kind of a snapshot of his like moral development. So that's one thing. I think most of us don't live, you know, stormy, monumental lives, but we all have to react to the small dramas around us it's just that history of what you see and what you think about what you see that really makes us who we are. So I think I start with that your life doesn't have to be incredibly exciting to be of great. It's obviously just of great interest to you, and it would be of great interest to anybody who could get close to you. And I think one of the things that I'm trying to do in this book is talk about the unfulfilled longings in these characters. So my main character, Sarah, had all sorts of intellectual ideas about herself. She's a feminist in college. She went to graduate school. She almost got a PhD. She didn't. And she's suffering from some feeling that she thought she was special, but she's discovered that she's just ordinary. And I think that's a very familiar feeling for a lot of people. And I think parenthood often means the end of certain kinds of dreams that you might have for yourself, or that's what the culture suggests. And so she's struggling against some feeling that her life is less than she thought it should be. And so I think that feeling of unfulfilled longing really charges her life. And when she makes a kind of bold decision to change her life in the book, it's not just a kind of stupid mistake. I mean, it's a real attempt to kind of change the course of her life and find something beautiful, even in a kind of tawdry circumstances.
So you're creating tension by moving the characters, contrasting the characters' reality to their dreams of themselves, and that tension exists as they want to move from one to the other and realize maybe they can, maybe they can't, and make decisions based on those desires.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say it's not something that's unique to me. I mean, this is, I think, what novels do on the most basic level. You know, you think of something like Don Quixote, which, you know, and which, by the way, is not so dissimilar to Madame Bovary, which is a book I reference a whole lot in this book. They're both, those are characters who read a lot of romantic literature. You know, Don Quixote read the chivalric literature and wants to see himself as a knight. Madame Bovary has read lots of kind of romance, you know, early romance stuff. I mean, she wants to see herself as a romantic heroine as well. And, you know, their circumstances don't live up to their literary models, but they forge ahead nonetheless, you know, and it is about that interplay between the inner world and the outer world.
Tell us a little bit about this book and Madame Bovary.
Well, you know, this book on its most basic level, is a drama of suburban adultery. Sarah's a stay-at-home mom, and one day at the playground, she meets a man named Todd, who's a stay-at-home dad, who's a very good-looking man, a former jock, who is there with his son. The other mothers call him the prom king. And Sarah and Todd, with surprising speed, you know, become enmeshed in a passionate affair. And so in that sense, you know, Madame Bovary is the early prototype for any kind of suburban adultery book. There's that, but there's also a very explicit use of Madame Bovary in this book, where Sarah is invited to a book group with a lot of older women who live in her neighborhood who are former school teachers. And when she gets there, she discovers her nemesis from the playground is there, her small-minded nemesis. And they engage in a debate about Madame Bovary that really is a kind of debate about what Sarah's doing in this affair with Todd. So it's a, Madame Bovary is both a model for little children and a kind of, you know, live text within little children.
In a way, this book is quite a bit about the fruits of feminism, both for the women and for the men.
That's an interesting way to put it. And see, this is another way in which when you say, you know, this is about America, the petty, one of the things that feminism taught us is that it's in the pettiest or smallest facts of our lives that we find, you know, politics always. And, you know, I was very explicitly thinking about this book in terms of the generation of women that I went to college with. Because I remember very vividly, you know, 20 years ago, staying up late and, you know, vowing to one another, you know, men and women both, that we were going to do it differently. It wasn't going to be that old world of the man goes out and works and the woman stays home and raises the kids. You know, women were getting educations. They had dreams. They were going to do it. Everyone was going to find some new way to do it, to share more equitably, to break old patterns. And, you know, 20 years later, I think very few people have found ways to break the old patterns. Or, I mean, I think some people have, and there are a lot of women who are out working, but a lot of women that I knew who made those vows actually have found themselves in much more traditional domestic arrangements. And sometimes voluntarily, sometimes they were women who had careers. They said, no, I would really prefer to be home with my kids. Sometimes it was economically determined. You know, the husband had the better job. Somebody needed to be home. Daycare was too expensive. But Sarah in particular really saw herself very explicitly as a feminist. And the whole first chapter really is about the odd path that she traveled, a path of, you know, career failure, you know, difficulties with jobs that kind of left her adrift. And when she was adrift, she kind of wandered into this kind of standard domestic arrangement. And it's a form of quiet torture for her, that she has in some way betrayed these principles that animated her early life.
And it's also highly ironic that the change that some of these people did make is that now, as in Todd's case, the man stays at home. And it's not that big of a change.
Mm-hmm. Well, Todd is a kind of a mythical creature, though I know that you're a stay-at-home dad, and I've put in my time as a stay-at-home dad. I think the thing about Todd, his big secret is he likes being a stay-at-home dad. His wife thinks that he's studying for the bar exam and is going to ultimately take on a traditional male role of breadwinner, and that it's just a matter of time. But because we have access to Todd's inner thoughts, we know pretty early that he's pretty much given up on that dream, but is frightened to tell his wife. So you have Sarah, a stay-at-home mom who wishes she had a career and a public life, and is kind of ill-suited to be a primary caretaker to a child. And then you have Todd over on the other side, whose wife thinks that he's about to have a high-powered professional career, but who really is well-suited to being a primary caregiver and wants nothing more than to stay home with his kid. So they're a funny, funny pair in this sense.
Well, you have a couple of other interesting stay-at-home men as well. There's Larry, an ex-cop who's on permanent disability, and then there's Ronnie McGorvey. Tell us about those characters.
Right. Well, this is the main subplot in Little Children, and the thing that I think keeps it from being, you know, simply an adultery farce about a stay-at-home mom and a stay-at-home dad who have a passionate affair despite, you know, the trivialities of their, you know, lives at the playground. Ronnie McGorvey is, of course, the manifestation of the worst fears of the parents at the playground. He's a paroled sex offender who has moved into this neighborhood to live with his mom, and they've been notified of his presence, and they're pretty worried about it. But Larry Moon is a ex-cop. He's in his early 30s, but he's retired on disability due to the emotional stress he has experienced after mistakenly shooting a black kid in a mall. It was one of those cases where the kid had a toy gun. Larry shot him, and you know, he was investigated, and he was exonerated of any criminal action or intent, but his life was ruined, basically. And he's home, and he's at loose ends, and then the sex offender comes, and Larry becomes obsessed with getting rid of him, getting him, you know, harassing him so badly that he'll leave. And he kind of sees this as a heroic quest, and he recruits Todd to join him in it. And so what you have in this story is a kind of humorous foreground where, I mean, somewhat humorous, because Todd and Sarah are not simply funny characters, but it is a kind of adultery farce set in, you know, among suburban parents. And in the background, this kind of much darker, more menacing story about a sex offender who may or may not have been involved in a horrible crime. He was never convicted of it, but was suspected of it. And this man who was involved in a tragic, violent incident, who now has his sights set on this sex offender. And it was the real struggle in writing the book was to figure out what kind of tone would accommodate both these stories and what kind of tension you could create and sustain between the comedy of the one story and the really unruly, dark and violent suggestions in the other story.
Together, in some ways, it almost reads like a horror story. There's a lot of tension, suspense. You know something bad is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, Ronnie has a way of popping up. You know, he haunts the book, really. And in that sense, he is a kind of a horror movie figure. Sometimes, you know, I use that ironically. I mean, certain times he pops up in all innocence. On a very hot day, he goes to the town pool and he jumps in, and Sarah and Todd are watching from nearby. And he basically clears the pool like the shark in Jaws. All the parents start calling their kids out. They won't let their kids share the water with, you know, this suburban monster man. But also he rides his bike around town, and you know, every glimpse of him evokes great fear. I mean, sometimes he doesn't even have to be around. At one point, Sarah loses her daughter in a store, and she immediately thinks of this man that she's seen on the posters. And so I think readers who are familiar with, who've read a lot of novels will know, I mean, you have basically a two-track story, and you have to feel at some point that these stories are going to converge for the book to make a kind of unified whole. And, you know, I was aware that there was going to have to be a convergence, and I think the challenge for the writer is to make that convergence both inevitable and surprising.
As you started the book, did you know how they would come together?
I didn't. You know, all I knew, I'd like to have a kind of natural ending point when I write a book. So like my book Election, you know, it was really about the outcome of the election and the aftermath. I wrote a book called The Wishbones, which begins on the day a man gets engaged and ends on the day he gets married. But in the interim, he has started a relationship with another woman. So the question throughout the book is he going to go through with this marriage given what's going on in his life? And I, as a writer, don't want to know until the very last minute whether the answer is yes or no. And that's a way I think you keep the suspense alive for yourself. In Little Children, I knew very early on that the story was going to end with a woman waiting at a playground at night, for her lover to come. And the question was, is the lover going to come or isn't he going to come? And I tried to keep that answer open for as long as possible. How Ronnie was going to fit into it, I didn't know. And that's really, that was the struggle of the book in some sense. And I remember when I saw how it was going to happen. And that was the day the book really became whole for me.
Let's talk a little bit about the not in my backyard mentality, which features greatly in this book.
And it's Sarah's husband, Richard, actually proudly says, you know, about Ronnie, he wants, they're talking about Larry's increasingly violent efforts to get Ronnie out of town. And Richard, who thinks of himself as a liberal guy in many ways, just says, you know, well, I think one of the other characters says, well, where's he going to go? I mean, he goes somewhere else, the same thing's just going to happen. And Richard just says, I don't care, you know, as long as it's not in my backyard. And he understands that it's a cliche and not a very flattering thing to say, self-flattering thing to say. But I think as a parent, he really does feel like, you know, let him harass somebody else's kid. Let him do his dirty deed somewhere else. And it is hard to know, you know, to what extent. I mean, nobody wants to live next door to somebody who might harm their kids.
That mentality really expresses a primal struggle of us versus the other, the aliens, the outsiders, which in some ways is why we all moved to the suburbs, isn't it?
I guess. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do with this portrayal of Ronnie was to see him as part of this community. One of the things that the book is about unruly desires, you know, people who have desires not sanctioned by the community. So, of course, Todd and Sarah, as adulterous lovers, are prey to illicit desires. Sarah's husband, Richard, is deeply involved in internet porn. And there are lots and lots of anecdotes about kind of deviant sexual behavior that gets integrated back into daily life. In fact, you know, to see these pictures coming from the Iraqi prisons right now, you know, just reminds me of the extent to which kind of certain sexual deviancy is kind of very widespread in this culture. But, you know, and so in that sense, Ronnie is not all that different from some of the other characters in the book, but he's also the one person beyond the pale. I mean, I think the culture that my characters live in can accommodate a whole lot of unruly sexual behavior. But of course, Ronnie is the one outside. And so he really is, you know, treated very literally as the other. And, you know, it's not like I'm suggesting in the book that Ronnie is an innocent victim, because he's not. But I am trying to explore the dynamics of, you know, why we do that, why there's this scapegoating, and, you know, some of the ironies involved with that, and trying to explore as a writer the loneliness and isolation of a character marked permanently as being outside of the community but yet living within it.
You actually do an excellent job, I thought, of creating sympathy for this man. Readers, I think, almost hope that he's not really, really, really bad. And you do a good job of creating sympathy for a gallery of characters who are not, by and large, what you describe as sympathetic.
Yeah, well, partly that's because there's some confusion that I think comes from Hollywood about what sympathetic is. You know, when Hollywood says, I want a sympathetic main character, what they mean is good-looking person who never does anything wrong, you know, someone without flaws, you know. Whereas within literature, I think what sympathetic means is, to some degree, you get inside them, you understand the story that they tell themselves. And once that happens, you know, the tragedy is that everyone has their reasons. You know, once you understand their reasons. They seem a little more human to you. In terms of Ronnie, I think the book's a little deceiving. You know, I think if you just look at what the things he says and does, there's nothing very sympathetic about him at all. But for most of the book, you see him through the eyes of his mother, his elderly mother, who is the only person in the world who will take him in. And she looks at him with this kind of just very melancholy, desperate hope that he can change and become a decent and, you know, quote-unquote normal person. And I think because you see him through his mother's eyes, you start to want him to be better as well. And I did it mainly as a kind of literary shortcut. I couldn't get in his head, and I didn't want to get in his head. I thought, I don't want to spend the next year trying to imagine the world from the mind of a pedophile. I will portray him through the eyes of his mother, who is, I think, actually one of the most sympathetic characters in the book, because she loves her son unconditionally and does her best in a really hopeless task that exhausts her, you know, to try and somehow reform him and make him happy. I mean, the first time you see him, she's writing a personal ad for Ronnie because she wants him to get a girlfriend. And there's just something so melancholy about the task of writing a personal ad on behalf of a convicted child molester. And again, there's a kind of dark comedy to that, but I was mainly interested in the pathos of it. And in fact, Ronnie does, the second time you see him, the second time there's a chapter explicitly about him, he does go on a date, which is, of course, a real disaster. And one of the moments when you realize that he may well be a certain kind of monster.
Could you talk about considering the audience? You're writing a book about suburbanites in the suburbs. A lot of people from the suburbs are going to be reading this. Do you consider the audience as you write? Do you think, boy, everybody who reads this is going to be trying to figure out who they're like?
I don't know. I don't know that I worry about all that. I mean, just recently in Boston, a Boston Globe columnist wrote about an upscale suburban women's book group that refused to read this. And he didn't really do a whole lot of reporting, but there was some implication that people felt threatened by the book or worried about it. But what I've noticed anecdotally, of course, is that a lot of people had their interest piqued by this article and felt like they wanted to make a statement of, well, I'm not the kind of prim suburbanite who can't stare my life in the face, you know? And so it actually created a lot of interest. I think, I've had the response run the gamut of, I know lots of women like Marianne, who's the sort of maternal villain at the playground. She's Sarah's nemesis, and she's an uptight kind of super mom. And I hear a lot of people say, oh, I know lots of Marianne's. But I've also heard people say, with a certain melancholy, oh, I'm a lot like Sarah. Or, you know, this reminds me a lot of my own life. And I think ultimately you're hoping that people feel a personal connection, that it doesn't simply allow them to express their superiority to characters who, make a lot of mistakes, which my characters do. But that the book becomes a vehicle for people to recognize their own lives and to think about it and to become aware of some of the pressures and tensions and joys, hopefully, even hidden in there somewhere.
This book also, I think, does a great job of looking at male issues. Men at home, men at work, men in sports. You've written about this before. Could you talk about this book as a outgrowth of maybe of your other work? Where in the path does this fit?
Well, it's very interesting, you know, because on the one hand, I think this book is fundamentally different from my other books because it is very much about the world of women and this, you know, this playground where they're mostly women and women as groups. You know, there's a book group and there's a playground mother's group. But you're right, Todd is a jock. He is, I think, feeling a little bit alienated from his body and from just, you know, that traditional way of being a man in the world and being with other men. He'd been in a frat, he'd been on teams. And one of the things that happens in the book right around the same time that he starts this affair with Sarah is that Larry recruits him to play on a football team that is mainly composed of cops. And Todd suddenly is regaining, you know, his place in the world of men. And so again, it's very appealing to him. One of the reasons that I think he puts up, he aids and abets Larry in a lot of somewhat nasty errands, is that Larry has restored to him some sense of his place as a man among men. That even though Todd has a maternal side and really likes being home with his son, the book is about the energy that he feels from kind of having his traditional male prerogatives restored. He's suddenly a sexual creature again, and he's also suddenly a man who is sort of successful in the world of competition and violence, and he's recovering his athletic identity as well. And so to some degree, I think the book is exploring just how stubbornly, you know, these models of masculinity persist even in the lives of men who have made a choice to move beyond them.
There's a lot of perversion in this book.
Yes, the original working title was "Hey Pervert."
Could you talk a little bit about our friend Richard and his internet addiction, and why you played that in, and the way you played it out was, I thought, quite surprising. Talk about that also in terms of both in as a male, an almost strictly male activity, and also in terms of, again, the other.
Yeah, well, Richard is Sarah's husband. He's an older man. He's been divorced. And the little bit of history we know about him is that during the early period of his divorce, before he met Sarah, he went through a period that he considered to be addiction to pornography. He was living alone and spent a lot of time watching, you know, videotapes of porn. And at some point, he was filled with so much self-loathing. He gathered up all of his pornography and put it in a bag and threw it in a dumpster. And he thinks of this as a act of like self-righteous purification. And after this, he makes a vow to be a better man. And for a short time, it works. And in this period, he meets Sarah. They get pregnant. He thinks, this time I'm going to be a good father, because he felt like he had neglected his family previously. But this addiction comes back in the form of a website that he can't stay away from, run by a woman named Slutty Kay, who's a kind of amateur exhibitionist, but who's created a kind of cult of personality around herself and sells, used panties over the internet, for example. And Richard, boy, he surrenders to this obsession and goes to meet the object of his obsession. And again, you know, the book is a lot about, one of the reasons I called it Little Children is that's a phrase that I try to examine from a lot of different angles. I mean, these are people that are raising little children. These are people, Ronnie's case is someone who's sexually attracted to little children. But also these are adults who haven't fully accepted the idea that they can discipline their desires. And, you know, Richard is somebody who just basically surrenders to this this fascination with this woman who's a stranger, and he accepts this fantasy as a kind of new reality in his life, and his journey and Sarah's journey are kind of parallel, but Richard somehow seems to be making this fantasy into a real phase of his life. As far as, you know, porn being a male thing, that's another, you know, Slutty K has a whole club of men who are devoted to her, and Richard finds a kind of community around that as well.
So Richard uses porn to achieve a sense of camaraderie with the world rather than divorce himself from it.
Yeah, and that was his a kind of journey, right? He was feeling very alienated by his reliance on this internet porn and feeling like there's something so obviously so bloodless and disembodied about it. But he goes on this journey that in gradual steps leads him to, a strange kind of communion with other people. But a real, real insofar as it exists.
I also found it interesting the way you worked Larry's point of view, so that in some sense, what's normal has become perverse.
How do you mean?
Well, Larry, having wedded and married a beautiful woman upon losing his job as a result of shooting this young man and staying at home, all of a sudden finds himself in a position where he's no longer able to function sexually, but he wants to. There's a kind of a tension, so that he almost views normal behavior in a sense as perverse.
Yeah, well, Larry is full of a kind of guilt that he can't acknowledge. But one way it manifests itself in his life is that I think he's unable to allow himself pleasure. And his wife finally gets fed up with him and begins divorce proceedings. And a lot of these thoughts that you're talking about take place in a chapter called Church on Sunday. Larry's divorce lawyer has suggested that he start going back to church because his wife is religious. He feels it will help with the custody arrangements if he's able to present himself to the judge as a kind of, pillar of the community. And he goes to church, and basically what he does is stare at his wife and kind of think about what went wrong in his marriage and think about his attitude toward her sexually. And I think it's true in a sense that Ronnie has given the presence of this child molester who shows up in church that day. There's a lot of inner rage that Larry's feeling, and then he sees Ronnie and he's allowed to turn that rage outward. There's something very suggestive about the juxtaposition of the story about Larry's failed marriage and his lack of interest in sexuality and his obsession with Ronnie, which in some sense fills that space. And his wife is very suspicious of his obsession with Ronnie because I think she understands it as a kind of substitution for self-examination or for some attempt to come to terms with his own experiences. It's instead of looking in and seeing, why he has begun to kind of hate himself, Larry turns all that hate outward toward Ronnie. And those moments when they're together are very charged because, they need each other a little more than they should. And they know each other a little too well in some way.
And, of course, adultery itself is a form of perversion.
Well, in the context of this book, it's like the only normal sex you get.
Talk about playing to type and against type and stereotype with the prom king and the playground mothers.
That's actually a really good question. And I'll try and answer it just by saying that it's something that I've been, as a comic novelist, that I deal with all the time. And if people have seen the movie Election, which is a terrific movie, I really think it's wonderful, but it fundamentally differs from my book in the sense that I play against type. The character played by Chris Klein in the movie Election is a dumb jock, and he's a very funny dumb jock, but we know that type. In the book, what I actually have is a smart jock, a guy who's a football player who has suddenly begun to be interested in the world, interested in politics, and he's using this election to kind of create a story for himself where he's not limited to the kind of life path that he thought he was before. And I've learned, I think, as a kind of comic thing that I can have my cake and eat it too, if I establish the characters first as a type. So you get all the laughs that come with pointing out, what makes a type. So Todd is romanticized by these women, and there's something funny about the way they treat him. He's compared to an underwear model. He's compared to a soap opera star. He's just a good-looking man in the world. But as soon as we meet him, we know that there's this whole other story. And in some ways, what he looks like is part of his problem. And there's something that you gain in a literary way of letting these characters grow beyond their types. So almost everybody is kind of evoked first as a type and then allowed to kind of grow beyond the type. And partly this is comes out of real life. I tend to be, I think, somewhat judgmental person. I tend to think that I know people right away and go, oh, I know who that guy is, you know. And there's always that moment, and I think it always comes almost with a sense of shame, that moment when somebody says something to you that surprises you. It makes them realize you didn't really know them at all. And they get suddenly bigger and more mysterious to you. They become real. I mean, that to me is a powerful moment in any kind of, you know, human relationship, that moment that somebody surprises you. And I hope that all these characters, you know, go through a kind of arc like that. The most, I think, surprising one for readers of the book will be Marianne, who we get to hate throughout the book. She's just the character we love to hate. She's always saying the most narrow-minded, you know, hostile things to our main character, Sarah, who we like. And so it's just, ooh, that Marianne, you know, what a horrible person. And very, very late in the book, you get some access to Marianne's thoughts at a very vulnerable moment. And hopefully you sort of leave feeling like even her, even the character who seemed most stereotypical, has a story, has some depth, is capable of being wounded, is full of longing for something else that she'll never get. So it has become a kind of method for me. It's why I sometimes feel like it's not quite right for critics to suggest that I'm writing satire. But I understand exactly where it comes from, mm-hmm. because I do think initially it feels a little bit like that. Like you're seeing these characters and you think you know them and you think their faults are heightened in instructive ways. And I think what happens instead of staying static as a character would in satire, in embodying this type all the way through, they deepen and change and they kind of slip out of the box that they seem to have been put in early on.
Let's talk about humor writing. This book is very funny. And I don't think I'd describe it as satire. As you say, the characters are too realistic. They're too real. You build a lot of humor into your prose. Is this the product of the first generation? Or is this the product of revision? Is this a product of planning? Or is this a product of you?
Yeah, no, I think... you know, I think humor is one of those things that if you're a comic writer, basically you can write about anything and it will come out comic, because it's mainly being attuned to absurdity. It's mainly a kind of whole attitude toward the world. I mean, you know, there's the classic definition of comedy, which is, you know, kind of happy ending. You know, in Shakespeare, there's marriage, the social world is kind of, you know, reconstituted, the society is confirmed. That's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about comic fiction. I'm much more talking about a moment-to-moment sense of the absurd. And I want, you know, my long-term goal as a writer, I think, is to figure out ways to write comic fiction about all sorts of serious subject matter that, you know, and, you know, this book in some ways is explicitly about that. I mean, you know, there are probably not many books that could be called comic novels that involve, you know, pretty serious treatment of a character who's a child molester or a cop who's killed a kid. You know, I think, and there's a lot of darkness. I mean, obviously I'm talking about dark comedy here, but a lot of the humor comes from the gap between what people are thinking and what they say and do, the lies that they tell one another, the strange ways that they undermine themselves when they think they're doing one thing. So this is very serious stuff. but it comes out funny because I think, you know, ultimately we behave in pretty absurd ways. It doesn't necessarily diminish the importance of our lives or the emotional impact of a particular moment. But I am one of those people who, you know, when, and maybe it's, you know, maybe it's politically not, you know, the most useful thing. I mean, if I'm watching TV and the president lies, I tend to laugh like you know, it's not like I think it's great that the president, you know, and it gets me angry on some level, but there's also just that humor of, you know, here's what's being said and here's reality. And the laugh is almost what marks the gap between reality and language or something like that.
Let's talk a little bit about little children. There are a lot of little children in this book, and some of them are all grown up.
That's right. And you know, normally I would not be in favor of, I think Little Children is a slightly bland title, and usually I think, well, it's very hard to get people to pay attention to your books, and you might want a kind of catchier or funnier title, but I could never find another title for this book because it seems so perfect on so many levels. The first time the phrase is used is in the first chapter, and Sarah says, she says, what was adult life but many moments of weakness piled one on top of the other. I'm paraphrasing here, but she said, most people just lined up like obedient little children and did whatever society expected them to do at any given point. So here, you know, Sarah says, adults are children because they don't make their own choices, because somehow society tells them what to do and they do it. I think a reader might say, these adults are children because they refuse to accept adult responsibility. They want what they want and they kick and scream until they get it. They're not emotionally mature. So there's some of that. Later, Ronnie's mother, when she wants to go to church, takes the Christian view of that. She says, Ronnie says, you know, I don't think anybody wants to see a guy like me in church. And she says, we're all his children. And there's that larger claim of, you know, we're all God's children. So I think there are a number of ways in which, you know, being a child and grown-ups being little children is a very evocative phrase, and it kind of shifts its meaning throughout the book, and it's kind of a prismatic concept rather than a little joke.
I have to ask about the dust jacket.
Yes. Well, you know, the original book jacket, and people may have noticed this, had two goldfish crackers facing each other on a field of astroturf. It's very kind of iconic but eerie jacket. I was really very pleased with it. But the Pepperidge Farm Corporation was not. They apparently have the trademark on goldfish crackers, even though I think the cover had somewhat modified them, and it wasn't like a direct photograph of a Pepperidge Farm goldfish cracker. They felt that their trademark had been violated, and they asked St. Martin's Press to cease and desist, which I guess, you know, the publisher felt like they had no choice, because if there was any kind of litigation, the books would have to be taken off the shelves for the duration, or the cover would have to be covered with a sticker, whatever. It was going to be a problem. So what they negotiated with Pepperidge Farm was that all the goldfish copies got shipped, but any subsequent printings would have to have a different cover. And so what we have now are two chocolate chip cookies facing each other on a field of astroturf.
You had a lot of success in the movies. Election was an absolutely enjoyable movie. Could you talk about that experience? About many writers have not had such a felicitous experience to have it actually done and done well.
Yeah, no, it was, you know, it's especially, you know, surprising, because that was a book I couldn't get published. Election was a manuscript in a drawer. And what happened was I went to a writer's conference and read from my novel, The Wishbones, which was in an early state. And there's a screenwriter in the audience who thought that might be an interesting movie. And she told some movie producer friends of hers that they should get in touch with me. And when they called, I said, you know, I'm not done with the book she was thinking about, but I have this other book in a drawer that I think you might that they might have some movie potential. And I sent it to them, and they liked it, and MTV Films optioned it at a time when they thought that they thought they wanted to do edgy films. They've since moved to a much more mainstream PG-13 sort of thing. But they took it on, and then they got Alexander Payne, who I think is one of the great American filmmakers, to get involved in writing the script with his co-writer, Jim Taylor. And then they wrote such a great script that all these actors, and it just unfolded like a dream. And I was a complete novice, and I thought, oh, well, this is how the movie world works. And in the, you know, past 5 years, I've been trying to, you know, recreate that experience, and have had, you know, much rockier time of it. And, you know, I mean, you look at a lot of writers, you know, really prominent writers, some of them never get a good movie made of their book. Some of them get, you know, but to ask for more than one is to ask a lot in the world. So I may have gotten my allotment. I hope. I'm actually working on Little Children right now with Todd Field, who is the director who did In the Bedroom. And we're, you know, we're hoping to make a good and interesting movie about it. But, you know, there are just no guarantees. I mean, there's so many institutional pressures and economic pressures and just Hollywood and political stuff that comes to bear that, I mean, everybody starts with good intentions. I think it's just the rare case like election where you get those good intentions to bear fruit.
Could you talk about what you're working on now? Are you working on a new novel?
You know, I'm just working on the script with Todd for Little Children. And I had been doing some journalism and book reviews. I just try to take like a little bit of time between novels now. I've been writing novels for about 10 years. And as I get older, I really love it, but I find that I need to recover. It's just such a, you know, it's just such a burden to take on. And I find that I appreciate the period without it. And once I'm in it, I really love it. There's nothing better than being in it, but actually getting in it takes a real effort of will and a kind of, you know, going down in the mines kind of feeling. And I'm happy to be, you know, up above in the fresh air for the moment.
When you're writing novels, have you written short stories as well?
You know, I started as a story writer, and my first book was a collection of stories. But since then, I've only written the very rare story. You know, maybe, but yeah. Right after I finished Little Children, I wrote two short stories last fall. That was one of the things I did, and that was fun. It was fun to get back to it. But for whatever reason, I have a difficult time getting them published. Which may also be part of what keeps me from writing more and more of them. I don't know why that is, but it's frustrating for me.
And you've done journalism and book reviews as well?
Yeah, I try and, stretch a little bit. One of the nice perks that comes with having some success as a writer is that, you know, magazines will sometimes come to you and say, would you do a story on this or that? And if you don't have a whole lot going on, it's nice to have that kind of work for hire and the freedom to investigate something you might not investigate otherwise.
We've been talking with Tom Perata. His latest novel is Little Children. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Oh, thanks so much, Rick. I had a good time.
Thanks.